It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. A new report from the Labor Department showed weak job growth in July and revised data to show a labor market that was nearly flat in May and June. The jobs report is just one indicator, but it has been seen by many economists as a potential warning of a slowdown in the U.S. economy. The report, released Friday morning, updated jobs data from earlier this summer and cut the estimated number of new jobs to small fractions of what the government initially reported. Axios calculates that these new figures show America's job creation over the past 3 months at just over 100,000 jobs total, the lowest three-month amount since the COVID-19 pandemic. Those are national numbers. What does it all mean for Wisconsin's economy? Menzie Chin is professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs and the Economics Department. Menzie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, good to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Well, you live and breathe these reports, Menzie. Big picture, when you saw these numbers come out on Friday, what did you make of them?
Well, I think the thing to point out is that the first number is something that you should never extrapolate too much off of. So the fact that you had only 73,000 jobs created when the consensus was 100,000, well, you got to understand that the government will revise that number twice, you know, in each succeeding month, and then there'll be a big revision like a year down the line. So 73,000 versus 100,000, not a big deal in and of itself, but the fact that the preceding months were revised down meant that you had this, you know, this drastic change in the trajectory that you saw. And so if I look June through, you know, from March to June, you know, you might have thought 150,000 jobs were being created each month. But afterwards, you know, something under 100,000, you know, by my calculation, about 64, depends which series you count. That's a big change. And that is what the markets reacted to.
What can we read into that? There's been concern that, hey, we might have a job slowdown sometime soon. Question marks like tariffs, labor and immigration, things like that. Again, this is just one indicator, but looking at those revised numbers, what does it make you watch for in the months ahead?
Well, I think, you know, if we look back and sort of deeper into the numbers, I mean, there's two issues that come into play. First is that, you know, if you look at the numbers, just raw counted numbers of jobs, there's this question about how you deal with seasonality. And, you know, there's no perfect way of dealing with seasonality because there's, you know, each year is slightly different. You know, each September is slightly different. But you want to get rid of that seasonality somehow. And that's an imperfect process. And, you know, like severe winters can distort those numbers. Things that are one off or changing times in terms of when the school year starts. Those things can throw off the readings. That's probably part of it, particularly with respect to government jobs. The other half, well, you know, it's hard to say. And part of the issue that's longstanding preceding these numbers is the fact that the first responses, when you call up people, you call up firms, that response rate has been declining. Mm-hmm. And so the accuracy of the numbers that we get when we call up these firms and ask how many people are employed, how many jobs do you have, that's been decreasing over time, ever since the pandemic, maybe even before. So you have several problems that could be driving these surprise results. On the other hand, I'll say that the 73,000 jobs in the, you know, versus 100,000 expected, that's, you know, in some sense, that's not super, super outside of what you would expect in terms of, well, we'll get more information later. These numbers will be revised over time. So, you know, there are several aspects of this that make it such that you don't want to say, you know, our system is broken in terms of counting jobs. I would say if you look at other indicators, like we have another survey that calls up where people call up people, households, and ask how many people in your household are employed. And when you count up the numbers there, then that too is a series that's flattened out. In fact, it's been decreasing over several months, but it's a very noisy series, so we put less credence in it typically.
Before we try to bring this all home to Wisconsin, I want to look at President Trump's reaction to the release of these numbers, firing the person in charge, the commissioner in charge of bringing these numbers and releasing these reports. And the president's National Economic Council director, Kevin Hassett, says, hey, that's just the first. There may be more changes. The president wants his own people there, quoting. So we see the jobs numbers that are more transparent and more reliable. What do you make of that decision to fire the person after this release of numbers that weren't desperately terrible, but not shining job numbers here?
Well, I think it's a terrible, terrible decision because first of all, it's completely unjustified. The commissioner really doesn't have the power to change these numbers per se. I mean, they're generated by 1,000 people working within BLS. It would be hard to manipulate these numbers. Now, you might say, well, could have done a better job. Well, one of the things that's underlying this is that the government statistical agencies, not just BLS, but the Bureau of Economic Analysis, the Census, have been starved for funds. Over time, their funding hasn't kept up with inflation. That's a problem that preceded this event, but it's going to get worse with the cuts that are being proposed. And so it's completely unjustified. It destroys the world's faith in our economic data collecting system, because, you know, what's the incentive for the next commissioner to do an appropriate, you know, job of managing the data? It's certainly not in the right direction. And, you know, as NEC Director Hassett has pointed out, this is just the first in a step of, in I think many people's views, just dismantling the statistical agencies so as to, you know, sort of eliminate any bad news that could reach the president and the press and the media and popular opinion. So it's on no count is it justified. No count is it a good thing.
Economist Menzie Chin is with us from UW-Madison, looking at the latest national job numbers. Let's start bringing it home to Wisconsin, Menzie. One thing that stood out, a decline, not a huge decline, but a decline in these numbers when it came to the manufacturing sector. We're hearing in the news today, Caterpillar blaming some poor performance on tariffs for their sales. Wisconsin, manufacturing is a big part of our economy here, proportionally compared to many other states. When you look at manufacturing job numbers and these reports, what do you wonder about? What do you look at in Wisconsin?
What I wonder about is, you know, why it took so long for it to show up. I mean, you know, all you have to do is go back to the last trade war under President Trump. You know, in 2018, what did he do? He imposed a series of relatively smaller tariffs, on particularly on China. And then there was retaliation. And it's exactly right. Wisconsin is exactly a manufacturing heavy, relatively speaking, even if we don't, you know, make a lot of steel or aluminum ourselves. We're manufacturing intensive and we're export dependent. You might say, well, gee, it's imports we're putting taxes on, you know, tariffs are taxes. But remember, you know, anything we export these days depends upon imports. And so what has the president done? He's essentially unprotected parts of the industrial sector, manufacturing sector, because what he's done is he's increased the costs of the inputs. So I'm not surprised at all that manufacturing employment has decreased. I think when the numbers come out for the state specifically, you know, the corresponding July numbers, that will probably have a decrease in manufacturing employment as well registered for the state. If not, I'll be surprised. But even if it's an increase, I think there'll be a continuing trend towards decrease in manufacturing. So for Wisconsin, as was well known when the, you know, President Trump, before he was even president again, threatened tariffs, it was clear that Wisconsin, along with many Midwestern states, was going to be particularly exposed to this trade war. And, you know, we're just seeing it. I mean, it's also an outcome of the fact that uncertainty is heightened. You know, even if the tariffs aren't all in place, you know, they aren't all in place because they're still being negotiated, even though we passed several deadlines. Uncertainty about what's going to happen in the future stops investment, stops hiring, you know, that might otherwise have taken place. And so once again, even if we didn't have any more tariffs, the uncertainty that has propagated through the system is going to depress, you know, manufacturing activity.
I want to run a hypothesis, I guess, by you that I've seen. I'm not clever enough to come up with things like this by myself, but an idea that amid this uncertainty, businesses are not excited to hire lots of people right now. They're also holding off on laying off lots of people right now. They don't want to make big moves as they try to suss out what's going on, especially with tariffs. Do you think that's part of what's going on?
Yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely. I mean, if you have to decide upon whether you want to build a new factory or buy new equipment that's going to be used to service exports, but you don't know whether the markets for those exports will be there, or you don't know if you'll be cost competitive because the prices of the things that you use that you import from abroad are going to go up, but you still don't know exactly how much because you still don't know what tariffs the president has negotiated. And you don't even know if those tariffs will stay in place because that's all proceeding through the courts, whether those tariffs are legal, these so-called reciprocal tariffs. You're going to hold off on both the equipment purchases and, well, hiring. Now, you're right. Uncertainty says, well, I might want to hold on to my workers, given how hard it was to hire them in the recovery from the last recession. You're frozen on both sides. Once the uncertainty is resolved, you may see any of the two things happen. You could see hiring increase, but you could see firings increase.
In just our last half a minute, Menzi, what piece of economic data are you watching for next, especially when it comes to things that affect Wisconsin?
Well, you'd want to see what industrial production is doing, manufacturing production. Those are numbers that are going to come out in about a week and a half. Those are the immediate numbers. You'll want to know CPI numbers when they come out for July, that is inflation, because the Fed is out there and the Fed has a mandate to keep price stability. And so people might cry when the Fed keeps the interest rates up because inflation is higher than it was before, and it looks like it's going to go higher. But, you know, people have been complaining about, you know, prices are just going up on and on and on, and despite President Trump's promises. Well, the Fed's job is to stabilize prices, and that's going to entail interest rates higher than they otherwise would be.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Menzi Chin, economist at UW-Madison. Coming up, a lot of communities around the country have lost their local newspapers. We'll meet three newspaper leaders here in the state and find out how they continue to serve small towns, rural communities, and smaller cities.
They see us visibly there, taking pictures, being part of the community, volunteering, and people know who the news people are.
A local news roundtable. That's next on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. A new study conducted by the nonprofit coalition Rebuild Local News tracked how many local journalists each county has around the country. Their data found 47 Wisconsin counties have fewer than 10 journalists each, with 15 counties having none. The study only counted publications with some kind of online presence, so print-only outlets could be left out. The numbers help illustrate some of the news deserts and other information gaps that exist in the state as more and more local newspapers have closed down over the years. We're checking in with smaller, locally owned news outlets around the state to find out how they're maintaining readership and continuing to serve their communities. McKenna Shear is managing editor of Volume 1 in Eau Claire. Chris O'Leary is the general manager of the Abbotsford Tribune Phonograph and publisher-owner of five newspapers in central Wisconsin. And Pat Riley is publisher of the Dodgeville Chronicle and co-owner of three newspapers in southwestern Wisconsin. I talked to them on Friday. Pat, let's start with you. The newspapers have been in your family for in the neighborhood of a century, I understand. As we've lost a lot of local newspapers, what has been key to keeping your papers alive and serving your communities?
Well, we work pretty hard at it. We're a family-owned business, so most of us are related, and those that aren't wish they were. So, you know, it's been a good family situation, and everybody's doing it for the right reason. We're reporting the news, doing our best, and keeping the public informed, and people seem to enjoy it. I mean, we do features. We do a lot of different things with the paper. We do some video on our Facebook pages that's been popular, and, you know, just we do different things to try to show the community we care, and they respond in kind.
And Chris, how would you describe the local news landscape in the communities you serve in central Wisconsin?
I think we're basically a rural area, so I think the weekly newspapers are a part of the communities, and people look forward to getting it every week. And if it's a day late, we get a lot of phone calls.
And McKenna, you've got an alternative publication at Volume 1 in Eau Claire. Can you talk about the mission of Volume 1 and how you're trying to serve the Eau Claire community?
Sure. And I can preface this a little bit by just pointing to the fact that Volume 1 started out as a zine. It was an arts and culture zine, totally free, kind of what you'd expect to see from a zine these days, smaller paper print, black and white, that kind of a thing. And then over the past 20-some years, after being founded in 2002, has grown into a media company. So the publication, the magazine, is bi-weekly, and we do circulation is about 12,000 to 14,000 copies, and is in hyper-local. So with that, we cover the Chippewa Valley area. That's mostly encompassing Menominee, which is in Dunn County, Eau Claire in Eau Claire County, and Chippewa Falls, which is in Chippewa County. So kind of the world that we fill is kind of the answer to what the community wants, if that makes sense. So maybe for the first, I don't know, dozen years, it was really hyper-focused on arts and culture. And maybe in the latter half of those 20-something years, we have definitely amped up the news coverage and more niche topics.
I want to follow up on a point a couple of you raised about meeting the needs of your local community. And Chris, let's start with you this time. How do you, in these rural communities, stay in touch with the community and figure out, you know, what they want, the kind of things they're looking for from a local paper?
Well, for us, we're trying to cover the things that they're not going to see anywhere else. So that's attending school board meetings, that's attending city council, that's going to village meetings, it's covering our county board meetings that basically the big newspapers have forgotten about. And then being at the events that are happening in our communities. They see us visibly there, taking pictures, being part of the community, volunteering, and people know who the news people are.
And McKenna, basically the same question. You talked about making that transition because you realized people wanted maybe more news coverage than you started with. How do you assess, you know, what the community is hoping for from Volume 1?
Sure. We kind of credit ourselves with being on the pulse almost of community because we are locally independently owned. We are the only independently and locally owned media org in our area. And we all live and work and play and you know, hang out here. And we get the luxury almost of choosing internally what we would like to cover. So we have a specific focus on arts and culture. That'll never change because, frankly, that's just something that some of the traditional orgs either can't or maybe their readership doesn't want to see as much as maybe we are doing with that. And as it relates to news and news-focused topics, we kind of jump in as we see the need as citizens and public members ourselves, what we think maybe needs to get a little more touched on or that we haven't seen be covered yet by maybe the TV stations or the newspapers in our area.
And Pat, for the Dodgeville Chronicle and the other papers in southwestern Wisconsin, what are you doing to make sure you're doing what the community wants you to do and is hungry for?
Well, I have to talk about my brother a little bit, who's been with me since we started this whole thing in, I think it was 1968, we kind of got together at the paper. He's a good one to go to breakfast, lunch, you know, all the stuff he goes on, talks to a lot of people. And every day I ask him the question, well, what's the gossip out there? And he usually knows, and, you know, we follow up on some good news leads from that and try to stay on top of the community based on what the people here are talking about and what they really want to know what's going on about. Ever since the dailies took a different idea on how to cover the area, we've ramped up our sports coverage a lot. We cover 7 school districts, 22 sports in the winter and 21, 22 the rest of the year. And that keeps us awfully busy. And we find out we have a lot of people who really like to read about the sporting events that they will never see anywhere else. And it's the same thing with the county board. It's the same thing with the city council. We cover, like I said, we cover 7 school districts. So we do a lot of school board meetings and things. And it's just a lot of work goes into listening to people and trying to make sure that they get their news needs met.
Pat, it sounds like it'd be really easy to be spread thin, right? A lot of school board meetings, a lot of school sports events, and all the other things you just mentioned. Are you able to keep up the staff you need to have that kind of coverage?
I can answer that in one word, no. But we multitask. We have people who will pitch in and help us out with some stuff, too. I mean, the photography, we have different photographers at about every school and game. That's another thing my brother does. He gets out there and recruits these people, and it really helps because that way we can, you know, cover things photographically. And then, you know, the good thing is there's, now that there's huddle and things like that out there, we can actually watch several games at once if we want to and assign different people to watch them. Because we're a weekly, we're able to get a hold of the coaches later than the day of the game, the night of the game, unless it's, you know, playoffs. And that gives us a little time to develop the stories a little better, too.
And McKenna, when it comes to staffing, you mentioned, you know, you still got the arts and culture coverage and the news coverage. Do you feel spread thin?
One word, yes. to Pat's answer a little bit too. Internally, I mean, we have 2 full staff journalists, full-time journalists, and that's myself and our associate editor, Evelyn Nelson. And then we also really rely on what we call contributing writers. Those are folks who, you know, are maybe either journalists themselves, but aren't working in the area, or were former V1ers, volume oneers, we call them ourselves, or community members, right? That just, you know something that we don't or have a knack for writing and want to write. And we work together with community members in that way.
And Chris, what's the staffing looking like at the Abbotsford Tribune, Phonograph, and your other papers?
Well, we're fortunate that each paper has about 2 people to be on the staff to go to meetings or cover sports. So we have 9 editorial people between the 5 papers, so it works out pretty well. The biggest thing for us is we have some really good sports teams, and having enough coverage for sporting events is more of our struggle. The advantage is some of our teams play each other, so then we can get coverage there, or we have papers that are close to us that will take pictures for each other too. But definitely it is hard getting to everything with the number of people that you have, but we are pretty fortunate that we've had editorial people, and some of our best editorial people don't come with a journalism degree. They're just community members that have found a niche and either covering a certain type of news or are really good writers, and we're blessed to have them working for us.
We are digging into the state of local news coverage here in Wisconsin with Chris O'Leary with the Tribune Phonograph in Abbotsford, publisher of other papers as well. Pat Riley with the Dodgeville Chronicle, also involved with other papers. McKenna Shear from Volume 1 in Eau Claire. We hear often about declining trust in the news media, and when people are polled on that, they might be thinking of, you know, the cable news networks or public radio or big national papers, who knows. Want to check in with each of you on how you work to build trust and how you, if you feel trusted in your local community. Chris, let's start with you this time. What does trust look like between you, your staff, and your local communities?
I think we do have a level of trust because I think we are not afraid to step on toes or hurt feelings because we want the truth out there. We're not afraid to have strong editorials and have opinions about things that are happening in our communities. And I think that helps people realize we're just, our main focus is making sure we have strong communities and we represent our communities, but we're going to be honest and truthful in how we cover things.
And Pat, what does that trust, that connection look like between your papers and the communities you serve?
Well, I often in the editorials mentioned the fact that if it's not the truth, we're not going to print it. And we work very hard to make sure everything that we put in is the truth as we can find it out to be. And we create some animosity at times, but you know, it goes away. People understand that it's nothing personal. You know, we're doing the best we can and reporting the news. And I can honestly say I haven't lost any friends over anything in the 50 some years I've been doing this. So we must be doing it right. So like I said, if it's not the truth, we're not going to print it. And we make sure we substantiate everything.
And McKenna, trust Volume 1 and the Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls and neighboring communities. How do you build that?
Sure. So I mean, inherently, as an alternative publication, it's all in the name. We exist as the alternate to traditional media. And for us, that was because we needed and wanted to fill that void that we felt was there relating arts and the vibrancy that was here that maybe wasn't necessarily getting covered. And over the past 20 something years, I think that people just associate Volume 1 with positivity, with looking at these people and trends and communities in a different way. And that's kind of a luxury of ours, right? And we're not necessarily covering crime. We're not doing that type of maybe breaking news in that way. And that's a little bit of a luxury for us, that there's pros and cons to both, but that trust that we have with the community, I think, is just built in because they associate us with slightly different things. And being, I think, independently and locally owned helps as well. You know, our publisher and owner, he is born and raised around here. So you automatically start getting into that thing where families know each other and friends know each other. And I think that helps a lot, too.
McKenna, let's stay with you on the theme of alternative news media. You were recently part of the Association of Alternative News Media's national conference held last month in Madison. Did you come away with ideas, inspiration from your colleagues around the country?
1,000%. It was actually my first time going to the AAN conference because it was more in our neck of the woods. It's always, you know, somewhere different every year in the country, and hosted by Madison publication Isthmus, who, you know, we have something of a relationship with as well. And it was amazing. It was myself, our associate editor, and our marketing and digital media strategist who went, because the conference was July 9th through 11th. And each day was full of different tracks. So really two main tracks for creatives and journalists and publishers and marketing folks. There were about 50 publications or organizations that were represented and present. And it was just amazing to be in rooms with people that just get it. They just know kind of the landscape going in, even though, you know, we're all a little bit different, at least from each other. We're worried about the same topics. We're going through a lot of the same struggles and joys. But we had significant keynote speakers that we were all really excited to see. And that was the first day. It was Katie Drummond, who is the global editorial director of Wired, and Wired is fantastic. And also Tom Tomorrow, iconic editorial cartoonist, The Modern World. And so to leave, like, my cup was so full. It was a space just of camaraderie, and it was amazing. Yeah.
Chris, earlier this year, you finished your term as president of the Wisconsin Newspapers Association. What kind of things, as president, were you hearing from your colleagues, especially in the smaller papers around the state?
I think newspapers struggle with mail delivery to our customers and the postal increases, keeping public notices in newspapers, advertising in general, and gaining subscribers or keeping subscribers. I mean, that's kind of the goal, is to make sure that we have people to have a good product, but we still need to get that product to our readers. And that is a struggle that is caused by mail delays, postal increases, shifts to advertising, that subscribers have had to take more of a burden on the cost of that. And I think that's kind of a universal theme through papers in general.
Pat, you've been at this, as you mentioned, for a while. What stands out to you as the biggest change in the local newspaper business that you've seen in your time in the business?
Well, I think Chris touched on it pretty good there with the postal situation. That's what makes it hard now. A couple of years ago, we had a guy that subscribes. He lives in Florida. And he called up and he said, "Hey, I just got your paper." He says, "Nice to see that the Cubs won the World Series." Well, they won it 2 years before that. That paper is 2 years late getting there. So we face that kind of thing all the time. And then, you know, she's right. We get phone calls every Friday. We know we're going to be getting phone calls saying, "Where's my paper? Where's my paper?" We spend a lot of time checking to make sure their subscription's current, and it usually is. We ask them to check with the post office. They do that, and the post office says, "Well, I'll check with the newspaper," and they've already done that. Somehow that's got to get rectified if we're going to keep delivering. I think that's the biggest thing. We lose subscribers because they can't wait 2 weeks to get their paper when they're living out of state.
And we'll leave it there. Pat, thanks for joining us today.
Sure.
McKenna, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely.
And Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for caring about newspapers.
Chris O'Leary is the general manager of the Abbotsford Tribune Phonograph and publisher of 5 newspapers in central Wisconsin. McKenna Shear is managing editor of Volume 1 in Eau Claire. And Pat Riley is publisher of the Dodgeville Chronicle, co-owner of 3 newspapers in southwestern Wisconsin. They're with us today to share their experiences running smaller, locally owned news outlets in Wisconsin as the landscape of local news continues to shrink. Coming up, the city of Superior is featured in a new collection of short stories by Wisconsin author Anthony Bukowski.
I desire no place but Superior. I wanted to live here. I couldn't be happy anywhere else.
Meet the author of The Thief of Words next on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. The city of Superior is at the heart of a new collection of short stories by a Wisconsin author with a lifelong bond with the community. Anthony Bukowski was born there and has lived most of his life there. He's written a number of short story collections. His latest follows characters, many of them Polish-American, as they seek connection and community in Superior and beyond. Anthony Bukowski is a professor emeritus at UW-Superior. His new book is called The Thief of Words. Tony, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rob.
Now, reading the book, I realize I don't see a lot of books with Polish-American people in places like Superior in Louisiana in the post-World War II era. What drew you to their stories? And I'm guessing it's partly your own background.
Well, it is, Rob. My grandparents on both sides came from the old country, and I'm old enough that I can remember them. They were alive when I was young. I was very young, but I do remember them. And I went to a Polish church. It's now been razed, so we can't attend St. Adalbert's Church anymore. But this is very much a part of my life, my upbringing. I went to a Polish Catholic grade school, St. Adalbert's in the east end of Superior. And it's informed my life and improved it, I think, and gave me some foundation, some place, some culture to which I can belong.
Staying with that Polish-American background for a moment, one thing that comes up in a couple of the stories is, you know, the Polish fraternal groups, the churches. Well, they're less and less Polish over time. Fewer people are participating in these groups. And I remember my own upbringing, going to weddings at the Polish Farmers Hall. Well, that's not there anymore in my own hometown. That sense that some of that identity is fading over time.
Well, it's fading for sure, Rob. Some years ago, the bishop here in Superior closed three of our ethnic parishes. There was a Slovak parish, St. Cyril and Methodius, and two Polish parishes, St. Stanislaus and my own, St. Adalbert's, but they're gone. And as I said, our St. Adalbert's grade school is gone, so too is St. Stanislaus. Our Polish club has really dwindled in its numbers. I was the president once. The club was founded in 1928, and I remember even 25 years ago when it was a larger Polish club. But now we have about 12 members attend during our monthly meetings. But there's something about us that just won't quit. People with the wonderful names like Dombrowski and Novozhinsky and Zuhovsky, we're still there, and the old ones are in our memories.
Superior, the community, is a character almost, bringing the different stories in this book together. Can you talk about how you bring Superior and have this this sense of place, this flavor?
Well, Rob, I desire no place but Superior. I wanted to live here, and my wife and I had gone away sometimes. We lived in most beautiful places, Lexington, Massachusetts. We lived in Natchitoches, Louisiana, which is a gorgeous town, and which appears in this book of stories. But always my heart longed to return to my home. I couldn't be happy anywhere else.
And you mentioned Louisiana. Your stories take place in this book a lot in Superior, but also in New Orleans and elsewhere in Louisiana. And that, it sounds like, came from some of your historical research as well. A lot of Polish people coming to the United States, especially resettled after World War II, came into basically sort of work camps, resettlement camps in Louisiana. Can you share some of that story?
I don't think American readers know much about, well, you mentioned this earlier in your introduction about Polish American culture. The one thing I doubt most Americans know is that a number of Poles came in after World War II under the Displaced Persons Act and then the Louisiana Resettlement Act, and they ended up coming through New Orleans as the port of entry and working in the cane fields of Louisiana. And my wife and I lived in Natchitoches, Louisiana, and taught, and I've been down to the cane harvest before, and there are still some remnants of that Polish culture there, but a lot of the people moved out of the working in the cane fields because it was just such demanding work, and so some remained in Louisiana to this day, but others left when various concerns they had were raised, and the government under Harry Truman looked into these concerns, and the displaced persons were then often sent to Michigan or Wisconsin or New York or other northern places, although some did stay contentedly.
We're talking to author Anthony Bukowski from Superior. His latest book is The Thief of Words. Another piece of New Orleans that comes through, Tennessee Williams. So you directly reference him in some of the stories. The author, one of the main characters, thinks of herself as a character in a Tennessee Williams story in many ways. And you acknowledge Tennessee Williams in your acknowledgments at the end of the book. What does Tennessee Williams mean to you as you're writing stories like these?
Oh, Rob, how I wish I could tell you what is in my heart regarding such great authors as William Faulkner, Flannery O'Connor, Tennessee Williams. Tennessee Williams has inspired me for years. Even before I read plays, I would see the names of his plays that had been made into movies. They ring with such poetry, and I fell in love with those titles, and I fell in love with Tennessee Williams' fictions and dramas. And he has been a great part in my life, and I have had the opportunity now to write about Louisiana and to write about Mr. Tennessee Williams. And that is something I had intended to do and hoped to do, and now I have done it.
You just listed a bunch of authors very much thought of as Southern regional authors. What is it about them that speaks to, you know, a kid from Superior?
I think extremes, maybe, Rob. I've thought about this, and I just don't know. One famous writer had said, when asked about William Faulkner, what was it he liked, that author said the heat and the dust. Well, I think the heat and the dust appeal to me, too. But I also think it's a matter of extremes. Whereas I grew up and now reside in my hometown in the north, right on hard on the edge of Lake Superior, and the cold climate we suffer here, there is the extreme at the other end. It's almost 1,000 miles straight down from here to New Orleans. So it's the extremes at either end that I think appeal to me.
Now, from some of the pop culture references, including the Elvis movie, King Creole, I'm putting in my mind a lot of these stories in the late 1950s or early 1960s. And this is a time that often gets treated as with nostalgia, right? When people in the United States talk about the good old days, they might think around that time. You don't, I feel like, treat this particularly nostalgically. Many of the people are adrift and unhappy. What are your thoughts on our nostalgia toward that era and the stories you tell of it?
Well, I think partly I write about these things because I wasn't allowed to see too many movies. My father was strict, and he followed the Catholic Legion of Decency list, where as a boy, I could only see movies that were morally unobjectionable for all. And yet I wanted, as most curious young people do, to learn about another side of life. I couldn't see on screen, but I'd hear my friends talk about Elvis as King Creole, for instance, a rebel in New Orleans. These characters I found so appealing, and so I have had the opportunity to imagine them for myself. And the King plays a big part in this, as do Jerry Lee Lewis and Gene Vincent, and Chuck Berry and others from that period. And it's a chance for me to imagine what I could not experience as a boy. I couldn't see the movies. When I'd look at James Dean on the lobby card at the movie house, but I couldn't go in because my father wouldn't permit me to see something like East of Eden. I can reimagine that now. And I can reimagine, as I say, Elvis as Danny Fisher in King Creole, or Elvis in Loving You, or Elvis in Jailhouse Rock. And it also helps me to write about the 50s and those great rock singers.
Now, from the title story, The Thief of Words, it's told from the perspective of a boy growing into a young man and his views of his father. And I've read some of your biography. A lot of the details overlap there, working, at the King Midas flower plant, the father in the story, and I believe your dad, if I have that right. Can you talk a little bit about the story of the Thief of Words and how it fits in, how it draws from your own life?
Rob, we're recording this interview at the home of my friend Tom Johnson. We are about a quarter mile from the flour mill. It's not King Midas anymore. I don't even know what they do down there anymore. But my father quit sailing on the Great Lakes, quit sailing as a merchant seaman. He came home to work in the flour mill. My sister had been born, and I was born 3 years later. And that's what he did. He walked sometimes 7 days a week down the tracks, under the viaduct, beside the ravine, past the oil dock, on into the flour mill, which was a terrible, noisy, dangerous place. He did it day after day after day, and he rarely took the car to work, though it was a quarter mile walk, if not more. He rarely took the car because he didn't want to get it dirty. So there he was. And then the poor guy takes his lunch bucket and comes home after work and has a beer, and maybe a beer and a bump, a beer and a shot. And then he plays the accordion in the evening. What a difficult and demanding life. And yet he endured. He endured. And he was sometimes difficult to my sister Mary and to me. And he is in the story. In the story, he robs the children when they want to talk and tell their father at supper about what has happened in their lives during the day. He starts telling his own stories and, in a sense, robs them of the chance to tell their stories. And the boy in the story resents this. But then later in life, when the father has died now, the boy goes back to that way that the father would go to the flour mill. And after a rainy night, a stormy night, when the fog comes in and it is warm in the spring, the creek is running high, the boy, remembers his father. And in doing so, he calls out his name, Father, Father, in two languages. The one language, he's calling Father, and in Polish, he's saying Ojciec.
A line from The Thief of Words, quoting here, I don't hate my old man. He's like he is for a reason. He never got to be what he wanted. The charity, I guess the grace that that he ends with really struck me, that and that scene you just mentioned as he remembers his father and calls out to him in English and Polish. Is that something that you experienced in your own life, that realization?
I'm trying to, Rob. I keep asking my father's forgiveness, though he's been gone since 1985. I pray for that forgiveness. And on the other hand, you know, I hold certain grudges, but who doesn't have grudges toward their parents? But I'll tell you what, Rob, my father, he had more strength than I have ever had, psychologically, physically, probably emotionally. I haven't one-tenth of the strength that he had. And here he worked all of those years. So there is so much to admire. And I'm glad that I could express this kind of confession in the book.
And finally, Tony, your characters, a lot of them seem to be trying to find a home, a geographical home, a home among other people. You were born in Superior, you returned there, and you've said that is the place for you. What is it that makes Superior your home above all others?
Well, I tell you, Rob, it's the smell of the oil refinery. Nothing like living a 25 or 30 years smelling hydrogen sulfide when the wind comes out of the south. We had the only oil refinery in the state of Wisconsin. You can hear also, to someone aware of these things and in love with these things, you can hear boats in the harbor. You can sometimes smell when there is a strong northeast, northwest, north wind off of Lake Superior. You can, I swear, you can smell fish from the lake as far inland as a mile away. All of these markers, sensual markers, actual physical markers, the viaduct, the creek, all of these things appeal to me. I know when things will bloom. I know when the lilacs will come out later than other places in the state of Wisconsin. I know that the peonies will follow them. There's so much to say about this place and so much to love about it. And that's what I have tried to do, Rob, through eight books. I've continued this thing, and it never leaves me. I always find new material.
Tony, thanks so much for sharing Superior with us.
You're great, Rob. Thank you.
Anthony Bukowski is the author of many short story collections. His newest one is The Thief of Words. He was born in Superior and is professor emeritus at UW-Superior. We're having a run of smoky days here in Wisconsin, with plumes of wildfire smoke from Canada affecting most of the state. We'll dig into smoke, air quality, and our health next Monday on the show. And we want to hear from you. Have you noticed smoky days in your neck of the woods? Do you look at online wildfire smoke maps or watch the weather for smoke conditions near you? And have you done anything differently because of it? Changed a plan from outside to inside? Kept the windows closed when you would have had them open? Tell us about it. We'd love to share your experience as a part of that conversation. Send us an email to get in touch. The address is wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. You can also call us or send us a text. The number to do that is 888-642-0232. Again, 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook, Lauren Cox, and Colleen Leahy. Our technical directors are Jeff Robbins and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.